This is The Conversation. It's episode 219 with Margaret Kerrigan. She is a Brooklyn and sometimes London-based art writer. She was in London when we spoke, and more on that in a second. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out images of Maggie Kerrigan out and about in London and New York and moderating a panel. And you can see several images from Jerry Saltz, who you will hear about in a second's Twitter feed, including one that was deleted. So check that out and so much more. Also, you can support the show and you can find recent episodes, including the great last episode with Lee Wagstaff. We initially reached out to her because of her article, Jerry Saltz Has a Pulitzer and I Have Questions, which was in the New York Observer a month or so ago, and turned out to be a great choice. She was really fun to talk to. She's doing a bit of a bi-coastal cross-pond type of experimental thing. She's going to be in London the rest of the spring over the summer, going back to New York. She gets to lord the temperate weather over her friends. We also talk about whether to cover or not to cover art fairs and her experience at Frieze, among other places, and what it's like surviving as a freelance art writer, which is kind of a hard thing to imagine. We do talk about that, among other things. I think you will enjoy it. And we, of course, talk in depth about the whole Jerry Saltz situation, her article about him and the Pulitzer and so on. So look forward to that. On the back end, I'm going to read some excerpts from an article that really caught my eye via the voice link, My Fears and Their Assuagement by Rainey Knutson. That was in Glass Tire. So get into some of that on the back end. And I'm going to make a facetious comment about the intro music, as you will find out, but I will deliver and we will get some real closure at the end of the show. So stay tuned for that. One more thing before we jump in, I am looking for some folks to help out on the podcast if you are interested and curious. Stay tuned for the very back end and I will tell you more. Let's jump in with Margaret Kerrigan right now. So Maggie, we just came in on Rod Stewart's Maggie May. Hope that's okay.
That's perfect. Little known fact, there was actually a Rod Stewart impersonator in my hometown for no apparent reason, but he was in like every major holiday parade. So very near to my heart.
Oh, okay. Got it. And have you ever been roasted or otherwise celebrated with that song in your life?
I think it's usually celebratory, although as an adult, when I finally listened to the lyrics, I was like, I don't know if this is like the kind of association that I want with this name, but okay, fine.
Right. So you're in London right now, and what part of London are you in?
I'm in South London around Camberwell.
Okay. What kind of neighborhood is that?
I would say it's kind of like Brooklyn.
Ah, the Brooklyn of London. Lovely.
Yeah,
perfect.
Exactly.
Right. How many freelance opportunities are there in London that you wouldn't have from New York, what do you think?
It's been really interesting because I wasn't sure what that was going to look like when I came here. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's a sincere interest from a lot of the New York-based publications that I work with to have more international coverage, that they don't have as many correspondents in different places anymore, especially as more and more publications are, you know, routinely forced to downsize or kind of cut costs in different places. So, you know, even if they have editorial teams in London, sometimes they're kind of strapped or things like that. So it actually has panned out pretty well, fingers crossed, that I feel like I have a lot more leeway with American publications to cover things in UK and Europe. And I wasn't necessarily expecting that. I was kind of expecting to report on things distantly, you know, happening in
right.
New York abroad, but it's been good. It's been a good exchange.
Meanwhile, as you've alluded to, there's the reality of publishing, you know, whether it's obviously the near dead print or the, you know, not very lucrative online. I mean, it's amazing to me that you are theoretically making a living as a freelance arts journalist. And I don't know how much detail you want to get into in that regard, but maybe you can just start on the safe side by just sort of roughly explaining how that can happen.
That is a question I ask myself every day.
Right.
Uh-huh. Not because I'm like, wow, I'm doing it. It's more like, am I doing it? Is this it?
Right.
But I have to be like painfully honest about it. It's not easy. And I don't know that the ways that I've done it have been particularly healthy. Like I've maybe taken on way too many projects at once or really pushed myself to my own detriment, physically, emotionally, mentally, whatever. And I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't recommend the way that I've done it to other people necessarily. I think that there, also that being said, I don't want to say make it sound like I've just been some kind of crazy workaholic. Like I've been very conscientious about taking time for myself and really appreciating that being, you know, in a late capitalist system, you have to be very mindful of what you need too. Like you are not a machine.
Yeah.
And I think basically what happened for me at least was it was a conscious decision to go freelance. So I definitely, once I found myself in that position, I took as many opportunities as I could. I started hitting up everybody I knew, being like, hey, you want me to write something? I felt lucky in that I had a good relationship with several editors at different publications already. And they reached out to me once they knew I was full-time freelance and kind of like, were like, hey, you know, we've got a story we can assign out. Do you want this? And so I really think it came down to just not being afraid to cold call people and just let them know that you're like, hey, you know what? I'm freelance and I am hard up. What you got? That worked out for me last summer, but it also put me in a position where I was working for way too hard and way too long for the kind of monetary compensation you get for freelancing.
Yeah.
So I would say that my personal project in the last 6 months has been trying to recalibrate exactly how much I'm writing and for where and what kind of projects I want to focus on. And that feels like a huge, for lack of a better term, luxury to mm-hmm. even have the time, money and headspace to do it. And it all came from doing too much too soon.
Right. So there was a point where you were doing, I don't know, you know, 8 articles at a time and probably feeling like you're drowning in them kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's incredibly difficult too when you first start working with new publications too, or if you haven't worked a lot with a publication as a freelancer, you kind of don't know their editorial schedules as well. You don't know mm-hmm. how certain editors work. You don't know what they're expecting back from you in the editing process. So once you have fielded that and plumbed the depths of all the different publications you're trying to work with at once, you can get a better timeline. Like, okay, X publication needs, like if I submit a story, they want turnaround in 24 hours. So they're going to submit edits and make sure they get them within that time. Others are a little more hands-off and they submit something and they're like, we'll get to this next week, you know, talk to you later.
Right.
That, I think the time management aspect of freelance is the biggest hurdle that I've experienced in doing it. And just in my own personal ability to churn out words and also, working with numerous publications at once and not having those expectations always clearly defined.
Mm-hmm. I think that expression churn out words is one that we're going to need to revisit in a couple of moments, but I'm going to save that for a little later. So you mentioned though cold calling before. You mentioned though that you have a bunch of editors that you already had been working with, you know, mm-hmm. so that you could reach out to them. How many people did you actually just really cold reach out to, though, not knowing them at all? Were there several mm-hmm. cases of that?
I'm trying to think now. It happens pretty organically, in which maybe you're at an opening or something, and I would meet an editor and be like, you know what? I'm very familiar with your publication, or I'm not at all familiar with your publication. Tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was less about pitching without ever having put a name to the face for me. It was more about the time it took to get out and meet new people and be at the right events or to just start showing up to more things on nights that I'd rather stay in and really trying to understand like where I needed to be to meet new people. It sounds really, really basic in that way when I say it out loud, like just like, oh yeah, just show up to places and talk to people.
No, it doesn't. No, let me jump in, because actually when you use the expression cold calling earlier, I that's always what I picture, that you email an editor, but what you're talking about is it actually makes a lot more sense and seems a lot more productive. That if you're meeting somebody, whether intentionally, like you're stalking them, I don't know, maybe you can talk about whether you've stalked anybody in that way, or whether you've been in the right place and happened, you know, where you knew there were just going to be a lot of art editors or what have you, and you got to meet them. That's not even a cold call. I wouldn't even categorize it as a cold call. I would categorize that as meeting them, and then, you know, you get to pitch yourself, right?
Yeah, I guess it's just more, you know, classic business terminology is networking.
Yeah, right. But yeah.
But that was something I think, something I've thought a lot about. I mean, I did do a couple of cold calls, but I don't know that they were so successful. And I think that's why I've kind of relied on just the sociability factor more so than anything. I would get responses, but usually they would be polite declines,
mm-hmm.
cold call somebody. But so I think that having a relationship with an editor, or just having that ability to talk to them for 30 minutes and really get a sense, so they know more so who you are rather than you know who they are, goes a long way in this kind of increasingly spread out publishing environment with so many freelancers out there, because they obviously they're on tight deadlines too, and they want to know that you seem like a trustworthy person that will turn in a story on time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
I actually have an extra thought on this.
Yeah, please.
I'd like to clarify.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm trying to think about this from a standpoint of somebody like listening to this and be like, man, I really want to like get out and meet editors, because I think that prospect seemed intimidating to me in some ways too. Like it can be really overwhelming to just walk up to somebody and be like, hi, I'm a writer and here's what I do. And, you know, and it took me a really long time to even like call myself a writer, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess something I want to clarify, and we can come and clarify for you and we can come back to it later. But also it's just like, I did know people already in the industry because I had been on staff as an editor with a magazine.
Modern Painters, yeah. Right? Yeah, okay.
So obviously, once there was a certain amount of bloodletting that had happened at that publication, like the word was out on the street that there were editors and writers available for work. So it wasn't so much like I was really knocking down doors and be like, give me a writing job.
Yeah.
But it was an incredible way for me to learn. It opened up my eyes about how I see the publishing industry now. And that it's not necessarily like a closed circuit or an insider's game, but everyone's so pressed for time and it's so insular in some ways that when they know that there are writers out there, they do want that they have worked with or know of or can be vouched for by another person. I think a lot of people just gravitate towards those people.
Mm.
And I all like, but that is to say, I've also experienced the exact opposite, which where I've been on the outside of that circle too, and had editors also reach out to me just via the comments I was leaving on their website.
Wow, that's impressive. So I remember a couple of things that I wanted to say and then ask, and one is that what you were describing or what you are describing about being an arts freelance arts writer is you're describing something similar to being an artist in terms of networking. I mean, chances are, I'm going to guess that most art writers or art critics or art journalists are a little less sheltered or a little less timid maybe in terms of networking than artists. Maybe that's wrong. But I was going to ask you, in any case, where do you see yourself on the introvert extrovert scale approximately?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I feel like I ask this question of other people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I would say like I'm a hard middle.
Right.
I can be very extroverted and I really enjoy being social and I don't necessarily mind just talking to strangers. But that's not where I derive any kind of rehabilitation, for lack of a better word.
No, that's a perfect word. Yeah.
So when I need to feel like better about myself, I go alone. But if I, but once I'm out in the world, I'm like, oh yeah, this is fun. Okay. Sociability is fine.
You're a good code switcher, in other words.
Yes. That's a good way to put it.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's good. Because yeah, I'm glad you understand the definition, because many people are not fully aware that introvert extrovert is not some kind of superficial thing. It's actually that as an introvert, you restore yourself and you get energy being alone. And as an extrovert, you do the opposite. You get energy and restore yourself being around people. So it's very hardcore in that sense. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so let's talk about perhaps the reason that we got in touch with you in the first place. And that is your article on Jerry Saltz's Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to, for people who haven't read it, I'm just going to do a very patchy job of kind of giving a synopsis, which is essentially you admit that you have enjoyed his writing and found his writing to be very clear and elucidating. And he's covered a lot of, you know, important shows, important artists. But in recent years, you've observed that he has been overdoing it with the sort of inappropriate slash kind of risque selfies, and use the word bro a lot, and then in particular, I guess, and you can clarify this, he wrote a piece which I have not read about his struggles and as an artist and then eventually becoming a critic, and was that article, did that article play a significant role in his getting a Pulitzer? And that was one of your, ultimately one of your biggest complaints?
I can't attest to the committee's leverage of that particular article in their decision to award him, but I know it was listed among the essays that they cited as the reason for his award.
Okay. Right.
And I don't know in what ways those were listed either. If it was like a hierarchical thing where they thought these were the best and then they listed them like top to bottom, like best at the top, whatever. But I remember reading that article and thinking that I appreciated the candidness of it, and that somehow, like, you know, the origin story of Jerry Saltz was important to who Jerry Saltz is and the way that he writes. And I think that's very true for him. But it also isn't something necessarily that I feel like does a lot of service for the artist he's writing about.
Right.
And I think that was what bothered me about that particular citation in the Pulitzer Award Committee's decision. Was it just seemed like, among all of the other things, how much he's written over the years, that he's been nominated for a Pulitzer before, and then to receive it at a time when he's kind of like max persona and minimum criticality.
Right, like, right, right. Yeah. Like
that frustrated me. This ties into other frustrations that I had that I think come out in that article.
Right, right.
Which is, there's a certain amount of just, I think I use the term buffoonery in the way that he presents himself. Mm-hmm. And if that's really who he is in real life and he's just having fun with it, then great. Like, I'm not trying to fault him as a person. This really wasn't meant to be necessarily a takedown of Jerry Saltz or even like a questioning of his merit for the award, because I do think he's a talented writer. It's more about, I guess, what the public is appreciating out of art criticism that really got me fired up about him winning a Pulitzer, and the fact that he was winning such a prestigious award when I think so many people within the art world find his criticism lacking in that way.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could keep coming back to about what made him stand out from so many other really capable, incisive critics today is that he was funny or had like a sense of humor that was part of his approach. And it got me thinking about at whose expense was that humor coming? And also, why doesn't art criticism have more humor in it? But that could be a larger question later.
Yeah. Well, you know, you made me realize as you were starting to describe your rationale or your response to that award, that whatever you say about Jerry Saltz and or his writing, he is an art critic and he was awarded as an art critic. And it's so true what you described and what you implied is it's so much about him and his persona. And you would think, I mean, logically speaking, an art critic serves the reader. They don't serve themselves, you know. It doesn't become about them. It becomes about what they're serving or what they're writing about. And he's sort of flipped that model, which, you know, some may very well approve of and say, you know, that's really kick ass and whatnot. But and by the way, and I'd be interested to hear what your, if you were to take a poll of your friends and colleagues, you know, what they would say. But I imagine that it's kind of, I really hate Jerry Saltz, I really love Jerry Saltz, and kind of a fair amount of people who probably don't care either way.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think that's the quandary that I think a lot of my peers in the art world have right now, is that they're just like, I read him because he's writing about the big artists and the big shows, and it's accessible, clear writing, and that's all very important stuff. I don't want to diminish that at all. But then so many people that I've had conversations with, like, about Jerry Saltz, like, I remember in grad school, we watched, like, snippets of his work of art show that he did. Remember that? Mm-hmm. It was, like, a reality show that he did.
Yeah.
And, like, we had a whole day of discussion devoted to Jerry Saltz. So I think that his influence can't be under, and it's getting people talking about art in new ways too, but it's also just talking about him, and not so much the art that's happening that he's covering. It's all about what did he say about it, which is maybe part of the role of the critic. And I'm being very cagey about this, because I think what Jerry winning a Pulitzer elucidated for me was more just how the problem is so much bigger than just him. Just because he's a big personality, I think the problem of art criticism is really not about him at all. It's so much bigger than just one person. I think he's really more of a symptom of a larger thing, where to survive as a critic, you basically have to be like a personality. You have to be a media personality. And I don't know that I want all of the criticism that I trust to come from media personalities.
Well, just to push back on that a little bit, I mean, other than him, how many big personalities that are art critics are there? I mean, I think the other art critics are very modestly profiled. Don't you?
I would totally agree. I would say that the second, or, you know, not to, I actually don't want to put a number to it. I just want to say an art critic of equal stature right now working is obviously Roberta Smith, who is his wife. And I think that that's such an interesting dynamic, and one that I tried to touch on really lightly in the piece that I wrote on him winning a Pulitzer, because she has such a different approach to art criticism than he does. And I don't know if that's dictated by the fact that she works for a place like the New York Times versus New York Mag, or if it has to do with her own personal ethos when she approaches art, or just in general, how she likes to cover things. I couldn't tell you. But what I will say is that I know of Roberta and respect Roberta's opinion just as much, if not more, than Jerry's. And she approaches it in an entirely different way, in which her own life is very absent from the criticism. And I learn a lot about the artist every time I read something by her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you learn a lot about the artist when you read him? Ever? Long pause.
I guess I'm struggling to think of a time where I've been like, the example that comes to mind is the James Franco piece. And that was just an act in and of itself as well, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
So And James Franco was art. You can consider him an artist. I'm sure he considers himself one. He may well be. I don't know, but I haven't seen his work in person. But I do think that was the one time where I really felt like I learned something about an artist that Jerry was talking about that I didn't know before. Was with James Franco, and I had a hard time considering James Franco to be just another artist.
Yeah, right. I understand you got unfollowed by Jerry. Were there any other results of that article that come to mind?
You know, the biggest result that came out of it was how I was actually expecting a lot of like hate, truly. Like I was expecting to get a bunch of emails flooding my inbox telling me how wrong I was about my assessment. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I actually got the exact opposite. I received one legitimate piece of trolling, and the rest was an inundation of people saying that they had felt this way for a while, but didn't know exactly what to express. And then it was a lot of artists that reached out to me saying that, you know, they wanted to understand why they've been frustrated with art criticism for a long time, and things that I said helped them solidify that in response to Jerry and things like that. So that was actually very telling for me. I don't actually know what to make of it entirely, because I feel like if so many people were feeling this way, why hasn't it been more blatantly stated before what I wrote?
Yeah. Right. I wonder if the Pulitzer committee, I wonder how much of that committee is composed of art people versus just general culture people. Do you have any idea?
I don't. And I kind of looked into that, and I wasn't really able to find much information on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it got me thinking about a lot of things in terms of art criticism today, just because I know that they have to equally disperse a criticism award across all forms of criticism. So that could be architecture, that could be, you know, visual culture, television,
right,
books, whatever. So art isn't going to be the biggest winner every single time.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a certain amount of conflation between visual culture and art writing, yeah, that happens today,
mm-hmm,
which I don't inherently think that's problematic. I think that's actually really interesting. But I think where the Pulitzer committee, I'm making a lot of assumptions here. I just want to preface by saying
that's fine.
That maybe that they think that to be an art critic, you still have to write like so much about just traditional forms of art or something like that. And that got me thinking about what Jerry covers. And like I said before, he covers the big artists and the big shows in and around New York. And that's useful, but also to my mind is not particularly avant-garde criticism and not really changing the face of criticism, especially in this, like, as we keep talking about how global the art world is becoming and the world in general, like to keep covering the same type of artist in the same place at the same spaces doesn't really necessarily seem innovative to me. And so I wonder how much of the Pulitzer Award Committee is made up of people involved with art as it is how it's defining art and where it happens.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something in what you're saying that reflects the accessibility of his work, you know, mm-hmm, that it's with a magazine that's, mm-hmm, that's a culture or whatever. I don't know what's the maybe better adjective, you know, a popular magazine, mm-hmm, not an art magazine, and that they, right, it puts him much more on their radar than the Roberta Smiths and, you know, and the ArtNet writers and so on of the world.
Yeah, I totally agree. But it's an interesting point you bring up when you were asking these questions about where are they looking for the art criticism, because there's so few art critics on staff anymore with any publication, like any general interest publication.
Yeah.
What there was a something quoted, I think, a couple years ago, saying there's only 10 full-time art critics in publications, in general interest publications across the U.S.
Right.
So it's a really small pool, if that's what we're considering to be, like, what it means to be a successful art critic these days.
Yeah, right, right. It feels a little like we're over time distributing to him. You know, of course, I did bring it up. We are talking about this article you wrote. But I wonder, though, if one of the bigger pictures or bigger takeaways is that he's somebody in the art world who has this huge following. I mean, what, is it 500,000 Twitter followers or something like that? And I think as people in the art world where things are so niche, you know, and small compared to the rest of the cultural world, we kind of wonder, oh, how can we get a piece of some of that larger mainstream audience? And I guess really, I mean, if you were to come up with a short answer, it would be, well, he was on reality television for several years. You know, that's how it happens. I mean, is it any more complex than that?
I don't know. That's actually a really astute point you make, because if that is how anyone in the U.S. just gains power these days, then maybe that's just the road we're headed down. That seems to be confirming, I mean, everything from Jerry Saltz to, you know, the president of the United States. If they're on reality TV, they must be qualified.
Yeah.
But that is a huge, like, leap in logic, obviously.
Right.
I think what this brings to mind for me is actually something about, have you heard of the book, What Happened to Art Criticism?
Who is the author?
It's by James Elkins.
I have not. Tell me.
It's a really small book. I think it's only like maybe 100 pages. But full disclosure, Jim Elkins was my thesis advisor when I was at grad school. And I didn't read this because you like recommended it to me, but it was something that I encountered in like just something that he had read actually after grad school. And I thought, oh, I should probably read this. But it's a great read. He wrote it back in 2003, and I found it incredibly stunning in how relevant it was, you know, now 15 years later. And what he says in it is he laments the death of art criticism essentially, and says that there's more art criticism than ever being produced today, but it has a ghostly readership. No one can quantify the readership. No one knows who's reading it. And I think that is maybe why someone like Jerry has such command right now, is because he has an easily quantifiable audience.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so interesting, because I often, even as a writer myself, like, I don't know exactly who's reading my work. And I don't know what dictates the interest at any given time in a certain artist or anything like that. And I also think that that's mirrored in the increase in like market reportage that we see in the art world today, is that that's just, again, a way to quantify interest in art. So I think that maybe is a little bit tangential to what you're asking. But when you say, like, is it just because Jerry had something like a TV show that he has such a big following, I think that there are all these other metrics in place and all these other forms of media that are really lacking in art criticism. And I don't know if there is a way to quantify who's reading about art these days. And I don't know. I think a lot of art publications are trying to figure that out very, very actively. But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question entirely, but that's where my head went when you said that, is that like there's a ghost readership, and what sets certain, unless you have the benefit of a big social media following or the like page views of a major publication, like there's no way to tell. That's the only way we're actually really qualifying, and what constitutes good criticism these days is like it's the ability to be seen.
Yeah. Right. Well, there are a couple of points that I want to bring up on the heels of that question or concept around the audience. And one of them comes directly from your piece on Freeze New York, remind me, was that hyperallergic or was it Observer?
For Freeze, it was Observer again.
Okay, the Observer. Okay. So your title for the piece, Freeze New York is flashy and Instagram friendly, but does that actually sell art? And the part of that that I wanted to get to most specifically, I'm just going to read the paragraph if you can bear, you and the audience can bear with me for a second. You write, but with the endless international schedule of major art fairs like Frieze, Armory, and Art Basel, and the countless small satellite fairs that pop up around them, it becomes more and more difficult to differentiate between them and the artwork they present, new layout or not. And just as a side note, you talked about the new layout that Frieze has. This is bad news for exhibitors who often pay hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to participate in art fairs in order to get their artists seen, which in turn prompts them to often bring the brightest and biggest works they've got in hopes that they can snag some free marketing via Instagram popularity and quote-unquote best booth roundups, something I've been guilty of writing more than once. So I don't know if that's a good segue or not, but and the other thing, maybe I'll just tie this into something that I also wanted to ask you about, which is that I think it's for The Observer, maybe it was another publication as well, that you do a number of listicle type pieces, which are those lists of, you know, the top 10 of this, the top 10 of that kind of thing. So that ties in with the best of. I guess the question is, to what extent are you writing those pieces to pay the bills? To what extent are you interested in that content? And so on.
This is a really good question, and I think about it a lot. I don't necessarily hate those pieces. I would say I don't ever really pitch them.
Okay.
But I do think that they generate a lot of interest, or at least clicks. And just because if it's a listicle, people know it's digestible.
Yeah.
And that's fine by me. I would rather have people interested and clicking than just being like, no, I don't feel like I want to read that.
And doesn't that, and just let me interject for a second, because doesn't that go directly back to what we were talking about, or what you were talking about in regards to this sort of unknowable audience, that how much is it the audience that isn't interest, that is more interested in listicles than actual, I don't know, heavy, dense art critical pieces?
Okay. So this actually gets into something that I think about a lot, which is kind of a basically anti-intellectualism in America these days. I think people really do, I at least want to believe people want more than a listicle. But they aren't exactly sure how to ask for what they're looking for. And a listicle is a safe bet because you can interject a lot of information into it. And if you've got a good writer for it, it becomes interesting. Like they can kind of thread them together, or they can make them all really pithy and funny. And that's all useful. And I think that they have a purpose. But I will say that I think in my personal experience is that the most attention I've gotten for articles that I've ever written, it's definitely not a listicle that's ever going to top like, oh yeah, that was really good work that she did. It was, it's opinionated pieces or something that really, in which I really present a perspective.
Why don't you give us an example since you're mentioning it that comes to mind?
I think the Jerry Saltz article was a big one where a lot of people took interest in that. But beyond that, like, I wrote one recently about Egon Schiele and why his work was being censored. And so it became more of like an inquiry into censorship using this, you know, early 20th century artist as a point of inquiry for that and how we're dealing with like the idea of being censored and also just like the limitations around what we can present online or in real life even and have it deemed acceptable. And that actually was like a really slow burn, but I realized that the page views on it were among the highest of something I've ever written.
Yeah.
And it didn't get a lot of like media traction per se, whereas the Jerry Saltz article did. That was a lot of other media people being like, what's this, you know, and like sharing This one was more like, I think, a way more organic, and it was just people being like, yeah, I don't understand what's going on with censorship these days, and I'm interested in art, and I like, yeah, I, maybe I've heard of Egon Schiele, like, it's fine, like, I'll click it. And I thought that was a really interesting case study in that, that I was very much looking at a historical precedent of censorship, and then also like how it's affecting the world today, and like, and trying to make it and relating it to things that we're experiencing every day in our own society. And it did great. And I didn't fully understand that, because there's a lot of other articles that maybe I've like poured a lot of heart and soul into. And this was mainly me just being like, you know, my own thoughts, speculating on something that might happen. And it really struck a nerve with people. So I guess that's where I think that people are really hungry for more opinionated and critical content, but they're mainly afraid of not understanding what they read.
Huh.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that does make sense. I mean, that's kind of like the classic case of a newbie to art, or somebody who is, you know, doesn't consider themselves knowledgeable about art, saying, oh, I don't know what it means, you know, and doesn't feel bold enough to weigh in because they would look like an idiot.
Absolutely. And I think that's such that in and of itself is, I think, a bigger problem than just the art world per se. I think there are a lot of things in the art world that are intimidating, even for people working within the industry. And, you know, I don't know how many times I've, you know, nodded along as somebody, you know, speaks international art English to me. I'm like, yeah, totally, sure. But I actually think it's more, it has to do with our cultural evaluation of art right now, which I think is really, really low, which also feeds into this idea of like, you know, what happened to art criticism, is that in the US at least, you know, the education around art is really non-existent, and or it's really piecemeal and comes through a lot of private institutions, and you know, and the funding for those kinds of things as well is so little, that I think that we're seeing that play out on a major scale right now, where we have so many people really interested in seeing art, and we have so much art and so much art writing and so many changes happening all at once. And I think people are really, really interested in seeing how that pans out and really understanding it. But as a culture, we haven't been raised to either like know how to ask the right questions or to appreciate it in the ways that make us feel like that it's for everybody. And I find that to be incredibly fascinating, which is to bring us back to maybe like half an hour ago when I first mentioned this, why I find this connection or this conflation of visual culture and art in art writing today to be so interesting and not necessarily bad.
Well, I was just, I don't know if I can segue from that, but I can segue from what you were saying just a minute before that, which is that in terms of the intimidation that you described, even within the art world, but also this separation, you know, in especially in the States, of high art and, you know, the people, you know, because of lack of education and so on. I feel like that can be encapsulated in something else that I wanted to, that I was interested in mentioning. It feels like this is, it's a fitting comparison. When you, another part of the article about Freeze, you talk about how you write, most collectors are often invited to art fairs and don't pay entry fees. They're ushered in by VIP car services provided by BMW to snap up the work they like the best. Meanwhile, members of the general public pay $74.50 for a full Freeze one-day package this year, plus a $4.50 service charge. So that's pretty, you know, that made me think, other than the collectors, the dealers' friends, and critics like yourself, who I presume you got a press pass, right? Who's paying, you know, $75 to go see Freeze?
I don't know. I'm so glad you asked that, because I don't know. And I actually went on I didn't go to Freeze on a public day, But I went to Armory this year on one of the days it was open to the public, and there were so many people there.
Right.
It was crazy. I realized how different my experience of art fairs had been just because I was going during VIP times with my press pass.
Yeah.
And I think that is also very telling. Like, there are people willing to front the money to go see an art fair. And here in the art world, we're mad about having to go to them.
Yeah.
All the time. Like, oh no, another art fair. Here we go.
Yeah.
So there's a disconnect somewhere, and I don't know exactly how to rectify it, or this might be the next article I write on art fairs, is like just interviewing people on the public day.
That's a great that's a great idea. Who are these people? That's a great piece.
Yeah, because I think that's something that in the art world we're so disillusioned with art fairs, but they have become this weird kind of pseudo institution in and of themselves over the past two decades, and they're everywhere. And maybe as, you know, specialists per se, being in the art world and being confronted with the same kind of artwork all the time, we don't appreciate the kind of change that they're actually making. I don't know that I want a commercial art fair to be the change in the art world we see today, but if people are responding, that there's something there that we need to pay attention to.
Well, you know, I was just thinking that here you've written this piece on Frieze, New York, earlier this month, and you just expressed your, as many in the art world do, your distaste or frustration with art fairs. What would it take for you to say, you know what, I don't, to continue writing pieces for various publications, I don't need to cover another art fair, at least for a while? What would it take for you to put your foot down and make that stand?
I have to be completely honest with you. I've actually never thought about saying that.
Okay, well, I'm happy to plant a seed.
I guess to a certain extent, I'm still kind of interested in covering them. Because of what I just identified, that like, I right. think that there's something happening. They're worth watching, even if they are tedious at this point, mm-hmm. if you go to so many. But
wait a second. What is worth watching about them? Exactly.
That so many people feel obligated to be there versus the people that want to just go on their own time. Like, this isn't even to do with, you know, critics and VIPs or anything like that. It's all the galleries that feel like this is the only way that they can keep their business alive is by participating in these very expensive fairs. And so I don't know if the perceived shackles that the art world is in created by these fairs is real or not, but they're unlike any other industry trade show, mm-hmm. which is essentially what they are.
Yeah, they're probably unlike any other industry trade show because people go there and lose money, right?
Yeah, exactly. But to get back to your question, to not cover them,
yeah,
I think that comes back to maybe better defining what they are and aren't doing.
Mm-hmm.
And once I knew what they were not doing, I would feel more compelled to be like, this isn't the need to cover anymore.
Right.
But they still seem to be doing something. And I think we're all trying to get at the nugget of something mm-hmm. when we go there. On top of that, I, you know, to be completely honest, like, I would need a little bit more of like a better day rate, I think, on my freelance schedule to like be like, no, I'm not going to cover this anymore.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Which goes back to the listicles to some extent. And I think, you know, just to put a cap on that, what we were talking about several minutes ago, you know, you've got the Egon Schiele type piece, and then you have the listicle, the list piece. You can do both, you know, and it's understandable. You know, you get a little maybe consistent income from doing the list piece, and it's relatively easy to do, and you get some traffic that way, you know, whereas with the Egon Schiele type piece, it may be very satisfying intellectually and you know, and otherwise to do, and you don't know how well it's going to perform, but that's okay. But, you know, you're
right.
feeding your intellectual soul and so on in the process.
Right.
Yeah.
I will say about the listicle really quickly, though, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I think because I had sent you a link to one that I had done for ArtNet, which was on, was it Michelangelo or
That's
Raphael?
Michelangelo, or... yes.
Yeah. That was a series that I did for them. I actually worked on with Ben Davis, and I thought that was a really interesting listicle because there was a lot of art history, like academic
right
citation thrown into it. And that was something that Ben and I had talked about as not in clear terms of being like, what, how can we reframe the listicle as something like maybe a little bit more meaty than just the fluff piece. But I did think that was an interesting exercise in understanding that people actually really wanted to know more about these things. And the listicle is a really easy way to do that. And how can you try to combine traditional art historical writing with something like a listicle?
I think that's an excellent point, using that Michelangelo, top 10 Michelangelo pieces that you did, because it does contain a lot of information that most of us don't know about Michelangelo, and it has pieces that most of us didn't even know were Michelangelo pieces. So it's definitely a very concise way to become much more educated about the artist and his most important works.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's potential for listicles yet if we can figure out how to use them and wield them well.
we need to start by renaming them from listicle to something else.
Absolutely. We'll have to brainstorm some ideas.
Right. So I want to just open it up, I think, at this point to maybe some bigger picture things. Like, you know, you've kind of alluded to some of your experiences, but maybe we need to maybe see if we can come up with one or two specific things. What have been either some of your big takeaways, being somebody who has covered the art world as, you know, as you have for the last several years, and or maybe what have been some seminal experiences or moments even that you've had?
I think my biggest takeaway right now is, and this is going to sound super cheesy, so I have to apologize in advance, but I'm constantly floored by the number of incredibly intelligent people working in the arts out there. I think what we're lamenting when we talk about, and not to make it all about art criticism, but the death of art criticism or the death of publishing in general, is just, it's not that the people that are driving that are going away. It's that they can be harder to find when these major publications kind of either shutter or alter their practices to be less than friendly to their staff and freelancers or things like that, by which I basically just mean like not paying people on time, because that's really a problem in publishing.
Before I ask you about a seminal experience, whether, you know, interacting with anybody in particular or a show that you saw, I do want to ask you if you have some familiarity with this Interview Magazine folding bankruptcy situation. And I thought of that both because I just was reading about it shortly before our call, but also because you mentioned writers trying to get paid. And here's a situation in which editors are owed hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the guy who owns that, the umbrella company of Interview, is Peter Brandt, the fairly well-known art collector. So I don't know if you have some familiarity, some thoughts about any of that.
I have so many thoughts.
Excellent. Go for it.
This also comes back to the seminal experience, I would say. As you know, as an editor at Modern Painters, and that was run by Louise Blue, and it was kind of a similar situation where she was failing to pay her employees and her freelancers on time, and it really devastated the entire media company she had built. And I don't want to, I think you can Google her and find out a lot more than I'd be able to tell you in a short amount of time. But I think that was a seminal experience for me about, I want to say just the art world, maybe just capitalism in general. in which there are a few people that are willing that see exploitation as the way to get what they need done, and they're really not afraid about doing it. In the case of Interview, I see them very, very closely aligned, both Bluen and Brandt, and that they are two individuals with a ton of money, and why they can't pay a couple thousand dollars to their employee in a timely manner is incredibly baffling.
Yeah.
So that for me was a seminal experience in just understanding in what ways power is wielded in the art world, and that is largely through money or who has it and who doesn't.
Yeah.
And how you can actually very quickly and efficiently suppress a lot of people by not paying them.
Mm-hmm.
And how that's eroding essentially our valuation of culture, and even to an extent, like how we get our news in general. What we're seeing with something like Interview, and also in my experience with like Modern Painters, is that those were two very established publications that I think it's very easy for us to say, oh, well, print has been dying for a long time. And that's not an untrue statement. It's incredibly, the overhead on a print publication is outlandish at this point. But it also has to do with the people that I think acquired those magazines and didn't value the actual creativity that goes into producing that, and the creativity you have to hire for it. And they think that it's just another saleable good, the making of which can be outsourced anywhere to anyone. And I'm trying to make this as succinct as possible without being like, you know, making a personal attack around anything on anybody. I don't know the financial ins and outs of running a publication at that level, but I do think that it speaks largely to a cultural systemic problem more so than anything else. And so, long story short, what we see when we see these like major art publications closing after so long, I think is not really necessarily a harbinger of the end of art or art criticism or anything like that, because I think there's as many, if not more, brilliant people doing amazing things out there right now in those fields. It has more to do with a lopsidedness that we see play out in all sorts of politics and socio-political arenas today, of how an elite few choose to spend their money.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's not end on that.
That did bring up a thought for me.
Sure.
Something I guess I wanted to clarify in what I was saying earlier about not paying staffs and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think that the way that this is affecting art and art writing, to my mind, is really reducing diversity, because the people that really need the paychecks to cash to continue writing are often not from a socioeconomic background that has been included in the art world before.
Yeah.
And so I think that is something incredibly important just to note, that when we see these millionaire magazine, you know, monoliths kind of just like collapsing in on themselves and then being like, well, it's just because it's an industry problem, not like a personal problem, I think that's inaccurate.
Yeah.
Because I think there are a lot of ways to streamline these kinds of publications today and to be able to adequately pay your staffs. And I think what's just not of interest is focusing on, I'm not saying this like appropriately, but I guess that's just something I really want to be mindful of, is that like, we're leaving out a huge conversation when you make writing essentially something that only a handful of people can do based on how little they get paid. So that's people with other sources of income and, you know, less student debt. So I think that it's this weird cinch that these singular kind of millionaire magazine people are enforcing on people, and it's really to the detriment of the discourse as a whole, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it occurred to me that, I mean, that what you're describing is a larger portrait of the art world as a whole, is it not? That for the most part, it takes a certain kind of flexibility, accessibility, and resources to be able to participate it on just about any level.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. So tell me, you're in London. What do you have coming up, not in terms of pieces, but like in terms of shows? Are there some shows that are going on there that you're excited to see you haven't seen?
The one I'm really keen to get out and see is the Joan Jonas show at Tate. Uh-huh. I think he is just a phenomenal artist, and I can't wait to see that in its entirety.
Cool.
And then I do think that there's a huge attention in the UK in general to installation and video work right now. And maybe for longer, I'm not an authority on the subject, but I think I see that so often integrated into public programming and institutions alike here. So I think that's really an exciting thing I've witnessed. And there's a lot of that happening in and around the summer, just like anecdotal art nights happening, you know, in different like venues around the city that comprise so much like sound and video and things like that, where I'm not saying that that doesn't happen in the US, but there seems to be a surplus of it here, which is fascinating.
Oh, wow. Well, it'll be interesting to see what you take away and then what it feels like going back to New York, you know, in comparison.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, Maggie, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thanks again to Maggie Kerrigan. It was great talking to her, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. Wanted to let you know before we jump into my fears and their assuagement, a very zeitgeisty set of observations and feelings from Rainey Knutson, that this is a listener-supported show, The Conversation, and your financial support is extremely appreciated. Would be very much appreciated if you could donate to the show one of two ways, either one time via PayPal or ongoing for as little as $1 a month via Patreon. Both of those are linked on the support page of the podcast. If you donate $30 or more one time or $5 a month or more via Patreon, you will be getting all of the lovely bonus episodes from Hildy, Lynn Helfenstein most recently, all the way back through to Max Maslansky, and you will get on the list. And I have a P-word bumper sticker that has your name on it as well, if you're interested in that. So thank you very much in advance. You can also support the show by following on social media at Artist Podcast. And if you leave a great review of the show, The Conversation, an Artist Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, etc., Google Play, it would be very much appreciated and will help other people find the show. Thank you so much in advance. Okay, so like I said, going through the Vice link over the last couple of weeks, this article stood out to me above all others, and it is called My Fears and Their Assuagement. It's by Rainey Knutson, and it is from Glass Tire, which is out of Houston. And I'm just going to read you about half of them, roughly. There are 10 total. Starting with number 2, I'm afraid the art world has been permanently destroyed by the art market. It kind of has. The gallery and museum system we knew and loved in the 20th century has given way to a gross hybrid of personal brand empowerment, high-end decor, insipid playgrounds for grown-ups, and shopping, our national pastime. My consolation is that, while the art world has little to do with art anymore, art itself is doing fine. It's still out there, even if it's increasingly not in its traditionally recognizable forms. That said, galleries have always been the first line of discovery and support for artists, and now they're hurting. If they disappear, I don't know what will step in to take their place of doing the hard work of studio visits and keeping ears to the ground. It's probably going to be up to the artists themselves. In some cities, artist collectives are proliferating and finding their own ways to get the work out there. Number 3, I'm afraid our country is inching dangerously towards civil war for no good reason. This really could be an essay unto itself. I say civil war because of the increasingly maniacal pitch of the discourse. The extremes on both ends of the political spectrum are both guilty of this, but Exhibit A is surely the National Rifle Association's chilling videos talking about them, meaning me. Is the NRA telling its adherents to get ready to kill people like me who advocate for gun control? It sure sounds like it. Unlike the abolishment of slavery, gun rights are not a good reason to have a civil war, any more than abortion, increasing income inequality, healthcare bankruptcies, systemic racism, climate change, or any number of admittedly very difficult issues. But it's really starting to sound like some people on both sides are itching for a serious fight. 4. I'm afraid the internet is making people crazy. This is demonstrably true. See number 3. Also, I highly recommend that you get off Facebook. It has done me a world of good. 5. I'm afraid popular culture is stupider and more insidious than it's ever been. Nobody can be worth a shit on an unrelenting diet of prescription drug commercials, cat memes, quote, journalism about Black Friday, and Dancing with the Stars. If you're as dismayed as I am, there's nothing you can do but cede the field to the slurry heap of garbage out there and maintain personal quality control by watching good TV and movies, reading good books, and listening to good music. It won't change the larger culture, but it will help you feel better, calmer, and more sane. I'm afraid this president, like Nero in ancient Rome, will make appalling behavior acceptable and normal for leaders of the United States. Given that he's the reality TV president, and this goes back to our conversation with Margaret, this is closely related to number 5. I don't know, every one of Trump's dumb, illiterate tweets is so horrendously awful with their moronic taunts of world leaders and petulant, boastful mewling, etc., etc. I'm going to skip ahead here. I'll let David Foster Wallace take it from here. Quote, if you are bored and disgusted by politics and don't bother to vote, you are in effect voting for the entrenched establishments of the two major parties, who, please rest assured, are not dumb and who are keenly aware that it is in their interest to keep you disgusted and bored and cynical and to give you every possible reason to stay at home, doing one-hitters and watching MTV on primary day. By all means, stay home if you want, but don't bullshit yourself that you're not voting. In reality, there is no such thing as not voting. You either vote by voting or you vote by staying home and tacitly doubling the value of some diehard's vote, unquote. That's from David Foster Wallace. And lastly, for now, I'm afraid of being mediocre. Surely I'm not alone in this. Someone once told me that forgiveness is overrated, and I think this is true when it comes to forgiving yourself for putting work out there that isn't your best. It will never be okay, but you have to keep trying. There's a reason there are so many platitudes. Keep swinging, keep calm, keep on keeping on. I think I can. It's a marathon, not a sprint, dot, dot, dot. All right, that's enough marathoning, not sprinting for now. Here is your moment of satisfying closure. Thank you very much for listening. Let us know what you think of the show. And like I said at the end of the intro, indeed, we are looking for more assistance. Lost a number of great folks over the last few weeks. So if you are interested in learning about volunteering as producer, production assistant, what have you, for the podcast, please get in touch via the contact page or just email me directly. It's all there. Thank you so much in advance. I'll tell you all about it then. Thank you guys so much for being here, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.